the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. We're going to be talking about an issue that really troubles me today, and that is an effort to really undermine parental authority when it comes to sex education, the sex education of our children, and in particular, sex education that takes place in the schools. Anna Quinlan's written a very interesting piece in Newsweek magazine, and there are news reports out of Great Britain and elsewhere that remind us that this is a very present issue. It's a very current issue. We are looking here at schools that are making decisions that parents ought to have the right to make. In Great Britain, we even have parents now under threat of prosecution for pulling their kids out of what they saw as, and rightly saw as, ideologically driven sex education. Here in the United States, under the new administration of President Barack Obama, there are expected to be changes. As a matter of fact, they are now reflected in the budget that the president has proposed for the coming fiscal year that will bring about a massive change in how sex education takes place in our schools. Anna Quinlan really helps us to understand what's at stake. We'll be talking about her article, and we'll be taking your calls. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Anna Quinlan goes so far as to say that what is labeled as comprehensive sex education, And that means sex education that is the what, the where, the why, the how, that provides contraceptive information, and even in many schools, sex-based contraceptive clinics and all the rest, school-based contraceptive clinics, that doesn't go far enough, she says, because it doesn't teach children how to see sex for pleasure. Now, I find that absolutely fascinating. That's the new sex ed curriculum to which many would have our schools pointed. We'll be talking about this on the program today. It's a necessary thing for us to discuss. It's not always an easy thing for us to discuss, because what we're talking about here, we're talking about the fact that we as parents ought to have the right. We must be recognized to have the authority to make these decisions in terms of the sex education of our children. And yet we're living in a society that sees parents increasingly as obstacles, as authorities that need to be removed in order that those who have a very different agenda concerning understandings of sex, morality, and all the rest can have greater access to our children. It is centered, you might say, the ground zero of this issue is the schools, but really the entire culture is involved in this question as well. At my website today at albertmohler.com, I posted an article entitled "God Is Not Mocked, Bernard Madoff and the Limitations of Human Justice." Today in a Manhattan federal court building, Bernard Madoff pleaded guilty to all 11 charges that he was charged with by the federal authorities. These charges included fraud, perjury, theft from an employee benefit plan, 2 counts of international money laundering. You now have the situation where Bernard Madoff is understood to have orchestrated and masterminded the largest Ponzi scheme in the history of modern finance. You're talking about a potential of over $60 billion lost. One of the most interesting things that came out in court today is that the federal authorities have been able to recover only $1 billion. It sounds like a lot of money, but not over against $60 million, $60 billion. These are all billion with a B, dollars lost. It's an incalculable, almost unimaginable, unfathomable amount of money involved here. You've got multiple thousands of people who have been virtually wiped out when it was discovered that this was not actually a credible investment opportunity. It was a Ponzi scheme. And as the Ponzi scheme operates, the money coming in is paid to the people that made the investments early so that there are apparent returns on investment, but it turns out that there really were no funds invested at all. Yesterday, one of the financial analysis columns looked at the Bernard Madoff situation with his Ponzi scheme and scandal and came up with the realization he was simply making the numbers up. He was doing it the old-fashioned way, they said, just making the numbers up. This points to a whole lot in terms of our moral equation. It points to human gullibility. I mean, one of the things that has to be asked in the aftermath of all of this is the moral responsibility of those who made these investments. You know, what should they have known? What questions should they have asked? You know, here you had a multi-billion dollar investment firm that was being audited by accountants that could hardly be found. There was just a whole lot that shouldn't have passed the smell test here, but it did for many years. And while we're talking about those responsible, federal regulators completely missed, even though there were signs and warnings, completely missed this. Even back in 2005, there were some within the government who felt this was a Ponzi scheme, but no action was taken, and now you see the collapse. As a matter of fact, you remember Bernard Madoff turned himself in to the federal authorities. Today, in this Manhattan federal courtroom, he pleaded guilty to all 11 counts. And so those who were the victims of his misappropriation, theft, scandal, they heard him allocute, that's the legal term, for admitting guilt and for explaining what he had done. Now, my point in my article on Bernard Madoff and the limitations of human justice is that no court can actually achieve justice. We need to understand a distinction between serving justice and achieving justice. I think one of the most important things we can realize in the midst of all of this is that we cannot achieve total justice, pure, true, accurate justice. Justice would mean restitution. Justice would mean restoration. Justice would mean that we would be able omnisciently to calculate the actual damage and then to come up with a punishment that would fit the crime and with the restitution that would return the victim to being whole. But on earth, there is no such justice. And this is a part of the Christian story that we need to keep ever in our minds. This side of eternity, this side of God's perfect judgment, everything is a penultimate judgment, a partial judgment, an inadequate judgment. It's a good thing that justice was served as Bernard Madoff was charged with these crimes and as he confessed to these crimes. Something that points to justice took place there. Those who were his victims had some satisfaction of justice of hearing in his own voice this man confess his crimes, plead guilty. But they are not made whole again financially. And it appears that there is no way that that will ever happen. There are those who were wealthy who are now poor. There were those who had stable and secure retirements, they thought, that are now going to have to find jobs at advanced age. This is a situation that obviously those investors never imagined themselves to ever be in. But it's a situation that is filled with morality. When we think about what's going on here, it just reminds us that there is no perfect justice this side of God's justice. But we are yearning for the justice that is to come. We are yearning for the judgment that is to come. Our imperfect efforts at judgment, necessary as they are for civilization even to exist, these attempts at justice serve justice, but they do not achieve justice. So we say justice was served. Yes, it was. But it wasn't achieved. The victim of the drunk driver does not have her spinal column put back together. The rapist does not have the memory erased. That is, the rape victim does not have the memory erased. The homicide victim is not given new life. Not in this side of eternity. Not in the judgment that humanity can achieve. Now, let's not be fooled here. Human courts are called to exercise justice to the highest degree of faithfulness that a human court can achieve. The highest degree of accuracy that any human court can achieve. But when it comes to what a court can do, it can only do so much. Bernard Madoff is expected to receive a sentence of up to 150 years in prison. How do you add up all that he did, all the lives that he ruined, all the lies that he told? How do you add all that up and come up with 150 years? Obviously, it's an abstraction. It's just the accumulated penalties of a justice system that actually doesn't know how to punish someone for a crime of this magnitude. The man's already 70 years old. He's not going to serve 170 years in prison. He's not going to serve 150 years in prison. He's not going to serve 100 years in prison. The reality is this is an effort to say this was a significant crime and this is a significant penalty. Life in prison will mean something. Elie Wiesel, the Holocaust survivor and winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature, was one of the victims of Bernard Madoff. And as he spoke to this, he described Madoff, he said, the word psychopath does not serve him, is not adequate. Elie Wiesel lost $22 million of his personal funds, another $15 million in a charity that he had established. He said this. He said he had his own idea of an appropriate sentence for Bernard Madoff. He told Portfolio, quote, I would like him to be in a solitary cell with a screen. On that screen, there should be pictures of his victims, one after another after another. End quote. Well, to give Elie Wiesel his due, perhaps something like this sentence could be within our human power to achieve. But the reality is, if Elie Wiesel got what he wanted in terms of this sentence to be delivered to Bernard Madoff, I think he would still be very dissatisfied, even after the sentence had been served. Just a reminder to us that human justice is so inadequate. We still have to serve it. We still have to establish the courts and honor the courts. We still have to charge criminals and try them. We still have to send criminals to prison. And we need to sentence criminals to what most closely approximates the appropriate sentence for what they've done. But at the end of the day, we are yearning for a judgment to come. Our hearts are yearning, longing for a satisfaction that no earthly court can give. But God is not mocked, and judgment is coming. Of that you can be certain. We'll be right back with the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Newsweek magazine is often interesting and provocative. It certainly is this week. I was just looking at the most recent issue, and I found the Last Word column by Anna Quindlen. She's always fascinating. She's a good writer, very clear, and herself often provocative. This is the headline. Let's talk about sex. Congress loves abstinence-only programs so much it has thrown big bucks at them. The public, it's got better ideas. Okay, now, the cultural left hates abstinence-based sex education. They hate it. It becomes an obstacle to what the left embraced as the necessary liberation of humanity from the sexual constraints of bygone ages. And as you look at the trajectory of the American culture from the 1960s onward, it wasn't just a youth culture. American culture at large really moved into an age of what they perceived as sexual liberation during the 1960s, started in the late 1950s in the literary world. And certainly by the time you get into the 1970s, 1980s, it's making a big impact. Sex education in the schools was, in the 1960s and into the 1970s, in the main, in most school districts, something related to health. It was basically human reproduction. That's what it was all about. By the time I was a junior, senior in high school in the 1970s at a very progressive, which is to say liberal, school district, we had contraceptive education that was presented to us, but it was still pretty restrained given what would come later. During the 1980s, and especially in the 1990s, there came movements for what was called comprehensive sex education. And the agenda behind this was to actually assume, to accept as a first principle that teenagers are going to have sex, that teenagers have a right to have sex, that no one should tell them they should not and could not have sex. So instead, sex education becomes not just about reproduction, that's a part of it, of course, not just about contraception, but that has an enormous focus in this comprehensive sex education, but about how, and I'll here quote one sex education curriculum, how sex is to fit into one's life, end quote. That's a very provocative issue. Now, Anna Quindlen is writing in, again, Newsweek magazine, saying that the American public is tired of abstinence-based sex education. Now, I don't know that she doesn't provide data for that. She just declares that the American public's ready for this. Tired of Congress pouring all this money, as she sees it, into abstinence-only sex education programs. She says they don't work. She says that they are throwing this money into these programs, quote, despite the following facts. Now, when someone suggests facts in this sense, better find out what these facts are. Fact number one, she says, they don't work. She writes, a study conducted for the Department of Health and Human Services during the last Bush administration showed that teenagers who took abstinence-only classes were just as likely to have sex as those who didn't, end quote. Well, you look at that study, and that study, as I recall, was actually called for by the staff of Congressman Henry Waxman from California. And you start to look at that, and it doesn't actually answer the question. For one thing, it doesn't tell us how many of these teenagers will be having sex under different circumstances. It can't actually in this study measure the individual decisions made by teenagers. It is one of these things in which you get the answer you're asking for. The second supposed fact, she says, is they're actually counterproductive. She writes, other studies have shown that adolescents in abstinence-only programs were less likely to use contraception because those programs emphasize only the failure rates of even the best methods. Okay, look closely, listen closely, to what she actually says here. The assertion is that abstinence-based sex education doesn't work. And the second fact, put that word fact in quotation marks, that she suggests in order to make her point is that they don't work. They're counterproductive because she cites studies that show that adolescents in these abstinence-only programs are less likely to use contraception. Well, you see, that's shifting the subject, isn't it? Because the goal of abstinence-based sex education is not merely to avoid the use of contraception, it's to avoid the need for it. It's a different issue. The third supposed fact she cites is that everyone understands this, end quote. Well, that clearly isn't true, because at least I'm included in everyone, and I'm hardly alone when it comes to the parents of America. An awful lot of parents are very much out of the understanding that she's pointing us to. She goes on to write, you need to hear this. President Obama's budget seems to reflect the sentiment of most Americans, promising to, quote, stress the importance of abstinence while providing medically accurate and age-appropriate information to youth who have already become sexually active, end quote. She goes on to write, in other words, we can indeed walk and chew gum, but not in abstinence-only education, in which students must be taught little more than that married sex is good and unmarried bad. Homosex, not even an issue. In the human sexuality curriculum in Utah, for instance, guidelines say teachers cannot, quote, advocate homosexuality, end quote, which, if I were a teacher, Anna Quindlen writes, would translate as leave well enough alone. Well, let's just turn that on its head. What then does she want? She objects to the assertion that teachers cannot advocate homosexuality, which means she clearly wants teachers to be able to advocate homosexuality. That's the only logical conclusion of what she writes. But I was shocked to read what came after that. Listen to this. It says here, even some of the comprehensive sex ed curricula are incomplete, with their emphasis on HPV, that's the human papillomavirus, STD, sexually transmitted diseases, and problem pregnancies. They seem to ignore one critical point, colon, pleasure. She puts a colon there in order to make the point that she believes that pleasure missing from this curriculum is something that needs to be remedied. She goes on to write, it's the equivalent of talking about salmonella and forgetting to mention that food tastes good. Now, I think there are an awful lot of parents out there who are going to say, now, wait just a minute. Wait just a minute. Comprehensive sex education is not comprehensive enough. This comprehensive sex education that means you're going to be teaching my teenagers basically how to have sex and how to use contraceptives, that's not enough. It's not even enough to hand them contraceptives. Now you want to give them basically sex advice about pleasure, sexual fulfillment. The cultural divide in America between the left and the right, but between, in many cases, parents and non-parents, not to say there are no parents that would join this bandwagon, I'm afraid there are. I read the other day of a mother who said that she had, when she had teenage boys, she shifted the cookie jar to be a condom jar. But I've got to tell you, not many of the parents I know are on that bandwagon. Anna Quindlen recognizes this. She begins her article by saying, there is a truth universally acknowledged that there is a deep schism in this country, a schism between those many Americans who support comprehensive sex education in the schools and an equal number who believe that only abstinence should be taught. Now, she argues that that's a universal truth that is false because she says that most parents are supportive of the notion of sex ed in the schools. Well, again, it depends on how the question's asked. If parents know what's going on here, and parents had better know what's going on here, then they're going to come to a very different conclusion. Now, at the same time, I have two articles before me from Great Britain where parents are being threatened now with prosecution for pulling their children out of school curricula that openly and undeniably promoted homosexuality. Now, you look at that and you say, well, that's Great Britain, couldn't happen here. Well, yes, it can. Just ask some parents in Minneapolis, parents in Lexington, Massachusetts, parents in California who have been told that they do not have the right to opt their children out of sex education that's going to teach their children the opposite of what the parents believe ought to be taught. Folks, I want to know how you think we as intelligent Christians, especially as Christian parents, as Christian churches, how we should respond to this. Give me a call, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. And more importantly, what kind of sex education do you believe is appropriate and who is appropriate to make the judgment call of what's taught? Give me a call, 877-893-8255. Twitter, Facebook, write me. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. This issue is going to be pretty much front and center of our cultural discussion here pretty quickly because the new budget that is being presented by the Obama administration is going to call for changes in the way federal tax monies are spent with regard to sex education in the public schools. You know, many Americans just are unaware of the fact that the federal government, through its mandates and policies, has a great deal to do with what's taught in every single school district in this country. And during the last several years, the Bush administration had pushed an abstinence-only sex education priority that meant that the states that were going to receive federal funding for sex education were going to have to follow the rules and teach with abstinence as the goal of the educational process, sexual abstinence. But that's going to be gone now. And it's in the typical language of how these kinds of changes come about. Rather than having the administration say, we're going to ditch abstinence, let me read to you again from what is in the budget statement from the president. It says that the promise is to, quote, stress the importance of abstinence. That sounds positive, but that's like, stressing the importance of virtue or stressing the importance of honesty while allowing for dishonesty. Because it goes on and says, promising to stress the importance of abstinence while providing medically accurate and age-appropriate information to youth who have already become sexually active, end quote. Now, when you look at those following words, there is an open door for anything. Because who's going to decide what is medically accurate and who's going to decide what is age appropriate? I guarantee you there are many, many parents in this country who believe that what their kids are being given in sex education programs is anything but appropriate, measured by age or any other criterion. I'd love to hear from you in this, and just in terms of the experience of parents, you know, with various school systems across this country, how you're dealing with this, how you think we ought to think about this whole issue of a debate over sex education in this culture. And do you think we ought to just assume that that parents should surrender authority so that schools make the decision about what their children are going to be told about sex, about marriage, about homosexuality, about same-sex relationships and all the rest, transgendered issues? That's something that has come up, of course, in the curriculum. Because remember, sex education is going to have to cover it all. Anna Quindlen is one who at least honestly recognizes that. She wants it to include lessons on sexual pleasure as well. I just want to know, how are you thinking about this? The number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. This is the kind of issue that we take on when we have to, because developments in the culture simply present us with the fact that Christians are going to have to think about this. They're going to have to think pretty clearly about this. What kind of sex education is permissible? What kind of sex education is appropriate? What kind of sex education would you as a parent say is over the line and I'm pulling my kid out? I don't know exactly what this means in terms of the long-term future, but I'm taking my kid out. What would you do if you found yourself in the position that several parents, any number of parents in this country have found, and that is when you're told, we're not even going to tell you when we're going to cover this material because we're not going to give you the opportunity to opt out your kids. That's simply too much of an imposition upon the school, upon the teacher, upon the process. Folks, I beg you, I plead with you to realize there are people who want the minds of your children. And many of them do not see themselves as evil forces trying to subvert parental authority. They see themselves as agents of what they understand to be enlightenment, liberating your children from prejudice, including what they would classify as your prejudices. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We're going to get your calls as quickly as possible. The issue here, of course, is where we draw the line. I'm not a prophet here, but it's pretty clear, given the shape of the budget coming from the Obama administration, there's going to be a massive shift in that. And I think you're going to see that eventually, if not immediately, those grants can be transformed away from an abstinence-based, community-based method and approach to something else, and that's what alarms me. Heather, I really appreciate your call here. I hope you'll hang with me through the break, because I want to go back to Anna Quindlen's article of Newsweek magazine with you, and you would be a real authority for us in this. I want to ask you if the facts that she lays out here are the facts as you know them. Be a great conversation. Folks, I'd love to hear from you, parents, youth pastors, a concerned Christian. What are you looking at in this? What are you seeing? What do you think we ought to do? What would you say if the school system turned to you and said, what is an appropriate sex education? We better be ready with an answer. We can't just be against what is being proposed. We have to be for what we believe would be right. Tell me what you think that is. We'll be right back.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mohler Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
We're talking about the coming issues related to sex education with the new administration apparently poised to change the policies towards a return to sex education that is not necessarily based in an abstinence-only approach. That's probably an understatement, but I'm trying to speak as carefully as I can, just because what is apparent in the president's new budget. We were talking to Heather from Nebraska. She was asking whether we believe that these abstinence programs, the grant money, is going to be changed and redirected. I believe that inevitably that's the consequence of this budget. But Heather teaches abstinence in the schools there in Nebraska, so she's an authority. Anna Quindlen is writing an article attacking abstinence-based sex education, and she says the programs don't work. She says they're counterproductive because teenagers are less likely to use contraceptives, and she says everyone ought to understand this. Now, I just want to ask you point blank, is that what you see on the ground there in Nebraska?
No way. The kids are totally eating up this message. I see it as we get what we expect out of the youth. And if we're going to expect them to be out, being sexually active, that's what we're going to get out of them. So one of the things I hear from the kids is that they get frustrated hearing two different messages. Hearing, hey, don't have sex, kids, but if you do, here's a condom. And what I'm hearing from the students is that's very confusing to them.
I really appreciate your call, Heather, at multiple levels, and I really appreciate your clarification there. I had a feeling that you were going to see that in a very different term. And I think it gets back to the fact that America is so deeply divided on this. There are Americans on the left who would see what Heather is doing as repressive and intolerant, and they would see kids as needing to be liberated from that. I really resonated with what Heather said about mixed messages. And let's think about the logic of what she presented there for a moment. These non-abstinence-based sex education programs, just to take the logic of Anna Quindlen's article, let's just take the logic of what the Obama budget statement said. Quote, the government will, quote, stress the importance of abstinence while providing medically accurate and age-appropriate information to youth who've already become sexually active, end quote. In other words, that's exactly what Heather's talking about here. It's a mixed message. You say you shouldn't have sex until you're married. But if you do, use a condom. Be safe. Let's just imagine, can we transfer that model to anything else we deal with our children? We don't want you to lie. But if you are going to lie, here's how to do it effectively. Here's how to minimize the consequence of lying. We don't want you to steal. But if you are going to shoplift, if you are going to rob a bank, then here's how to do it while minimizing the danger. I don't think any sane parent would take that logic and apply it to any other dimension of parenting. If we love our children, we want to keep them from evil. We want to keep them from harm. We want to keep them from sin. I know that's going to drive some people on the cultural left absolutely crazy to say that as parents, we want to protect our children from sin. But I do. I think probably most of you do as well. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We'll get to as many calls as possible. We had a caller call in saying she has a teenage daughter. She expects, sexual abstinence as the sum and substance of sex education, and I'm in total agreement with her. I think the big question here is just what do we expect in sex education? Do we expect a basic understanding? Because I'll be honest, I don't think anyone should be able to graduate from high school without understanding at least some basic facts about human reproduction. But that's very different than teaching about sexuality. It's very different than suggesting to kids that this is how you do it, and here's how you maximize pleasure, and here's how you avoid pregnancy. That's a completely different conception. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. The big issue here for me also is parental authority. And, you know, if I believe in parental authority, I have to believe in parental authority for everyone. It's like religious liberty. You can't say I believe in religious liberty for me and my group. You have to believe in religious liberty for all people. And believing in parental authority, I'll tell you, a parent who wants to exercise her authority to teach her children how to have sex, I can't interfere with that. I'll believe it's immoral. I'll believe it's wrong and insanely wrong parenting, but there are parents who will do that. There are parents who evidently have done that. But I do want to insist that any Christian parent should and must be recognized to have the authority to say, I'm not going to allow my child to be subjected to an ideological presentation on sexuality. It's my right as a parent to say, I will decide when they will think and know about these things and how it's going to be presented to them in terms of moral context. One of the lies about sex education is that you can present mere facts without ideology, without worldview. That's impossible. And Anna Quindlen actually concedes that point when she points to the sex education curriculum in Utah and says that teachers there are told they can't advocate homosexuality. She says, well, then, you know, they probably just leave it well enough alone. Well, again, that means that she wants them to be able to advocate homosexuality. I think that's very different. Let's go to Kevin calling from Louisville, Kentucky. What are you thinking, Kevin?
Well, yeah, I'm a teacher, and we have to teach by standards. I guess the same kind of thing in Utah. And so all that's promulgated by the state and by our local school board. So if the federal government comes in with money, the federal government's going to take over telling us what we're going to be teaching, and the state's going to stop. And I don't know. We've had sex ed in that have been led by doctors and nurses in my school and before. And parents always had the option to opt out. We always, you know, put that on the note. There always had to be a permission form. But anyway, I think the standards-based movement is really pretty strong in this country. So,
yeah, Kevin, I respect that. If you're still with me, what age group are you talking about here?
I teach middle school.
Okay. Well, I think that's very, very helpful. You know, as I recall, the eighth grade was the first time, and I'll admit that was a long time ago. You know, we're talking 1972. That long ago, over 30 years ago, in the eighth grade, that's when I first heard about some of these matters of biology and all the rest in a school system. But my father had already talked to me. I'd already had an understanding, a basic introduction to human sexuality and human reproduction that came from my parents. Now, looking back at what I received in the eighth grade, I have to say, I don't think it was very objectionable. I think it pretty much was, more or less, as Kevin describes, a doctor just describing human anatomy and physiology. But you know, when you get into advanced grades and you get into so many of these school systems, you get into the model of what's called comprehensive sex education, and it's another thing altogether. Back with final thoughts. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world, you're listening to the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. You know, the setup for our discussion here, the issue before us is the fact that there are systematic efforts, rather culture-wide, to deny parents the authority to decide what kind of sex education their children are going to be taught. And what we're looking at here with a shift in the new administration is definitely a shift away from the emphasis upon the abstinence-based programs of the past towards something that's very different. And that very different might be comprehensive sex education, as is known in some school districts now. And, you know, parents who don't understand ideologically what's at stake there, how explicit this is, what's included in that. I mean, comprehensive can mean comprehensive. Better have your eyes open as to what's going on there. But, you know, I really, in order to be honest intellectually, can't leave the situation there. Because it's not enough to say that parents have the authority to decide what's not to be taught to their children. I believe that with all my heart. I have to come back and say parents have not only the authority but the responsibility to teach their own children. And so the other side of this equation is I want to encourage Christian parents, be at this task. Understand that this is your job. You know, I was watching, you know, the other day a conversation going on between people talking about sex education, and one of them made the point that said it's just too awkward. Well, let me tell you, it may be awkward, but the stakes are incredibly high. And I just want to suggest that parents, yes, you are the ones who have the authority to decide when you're going to recognize the need and when you're going to meet that need with education. I want to suggest that instead of thinking about having the talk, that's the old model, parents need to think about having lots of conversation. Take the opportunity and know that children at different developmental stages are asking different questions, they're experiencing different kinds of issues, and rather than thinking of one talk at one time, either thinking that you can time it to know exactly when it's needed or that when you've done it, you've done your job, understand that our kids are looking to us for a sustained conversation. The culture is throwing all these sexual messages and sexual images and sexual kinds of media and content at them. The ideology is out there that suggests that they ought to be having sex and that there's something wrong with them if they're not. We've got to be there talking to them honestly about the reality of human sexuality from a biblical point of view. We've got to help them to understand what God expects of them. And we need to be very, very clear that we're open to a conversation because they're going to have questions. Unavoidably, they're going to have questions. And someone is going to provide an answer to that question. Parent, if it's not you, it's going to be someone else. And that someone else is likely to come from a very different worldview and understanding. So be about that conversation. If we can be of help, let us know. You can go to the website at albertmuller.com and find materials for help, other resources as well. We'll be back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. Thanks for listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmuller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmuller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.